right. Welcome back to the Earl Ingram Show. As always, you can join us at 844-967-2789. That's 844-967-2789. You can text us at that same number. It's Monday. That means Mondays with Sandy Williams. And Sandy, I don't want to get, you know, they talk about beating a dead horse. I don't want to get off the subject that you and I have been talking about for the last 15, 20 minutes, because I think if we are on these airwaves and we don't bring... but we're going to beat the dead horse because it's required.
Yeah.
I think for something as serious as what's happening with the selfishness, you talked about a book and a guy who wrote last week, a guy who wrote a book that basically addressed the American people and us.
Yeah, well, that was de Tocqueville. It was a French philosopher, a tour of the United States in the 1825 to 1830. Wrote a book that came out in 1835 that has been read by many history students ever since, in which he just described what he sensed to be the American character, the character of the American people who had settled in America and had lived throughout, who had moved throughout the Americas that he traveled in that time period long ago. Yeah.
You know, Sandy, dare we get caught in a critical race theory issue. But anyway, here's where Sandy, I just for the life of me don't understand why we look at things or don't look at things that are really going to be important for the overall survival of our nation. That's what should be at the root of all of these things, right? The longevity of the nation, and the people who come after us. It's, you know, we can live, you know, and enjoy life in the next 40, 50, 100 years, and the nation is still going to be a vibrant nation. But we're talking long term, right? I mean,
the country has so far been vibrant. Much of it has to do with the demographics of the country, the growth of the country, the huge, vast geography of the country. In many respects, America has succeeded in spite of itself, not necessarily because of itself. De Tocqueville noticed and talked about the extreme individualism of Americans, and he identified the fact that it might keep Americans from having the sense of community that might be required to succeed in terms of realizing the full benefits of what mankind can achieve. And now that's what we're talking about right now, is this individualism of Americans that has caused us to, in many respects, develop a very selfish value system, a value system that doesn't cause us to react to the global warming that is obviously a world community problem, that causes us to have a great deal of trouble reacting to the COVID health risk that is the community health risk, not the individual risk of each person getting sick, but rather the community health risk of our hospital system. It's caused us to have a lot of trouble getting our arms around the community problems associated with child daycare and a social safety net that preserves a lot of community values for individuals. It's caused us, I think, to look at the problem of the inner city and say, why aren't those people just fixing it themselves? Why don't they pull themselves up? Instead of viewing it as a community, we look at things as individual problems that need to be solved by individuals.
You know, Sandy, you look at it even on a scale of the states' rights. We've got to have our own independent states' rights, because somehow we feel better if we can dictate what we want. We don't want, it can't be national rights.
Well, states are closer to the individual, right? And just in the same way, the United States, there are many people who think the United States' involvement in the United Nations is a nefarious loss of individual rights in some respects, or at least national rights, because it'll be national interests buried in world interests. I mean,
right.
We just have a problem in America wrapping our minds around the notion that we should worry about things that are bigger than us being ourselves, and that we should all of us should look out for ourselves, and if everyone does that, we'll all be just fine.
You know, Sandy, so I was talking about this article in today's Wall Street Journal. Many baby boomers will soon need adult supervision. Not romantic, not something people want to think about, not something people want to talk about. But the shortage of caregivers for the elderly is becoming a crisis. You know it. I know it. Anybody with a modicum of common sense knows it. We're the baby boomers, the largest group, still. I think millennials outstripe us a little bit now. But there's still just a huge number of us. I was watching something, I think it was on Meet the Press yesterday, when they said that by 2029, no baby boomers will be left to fly planes anymore. By 2020,
they'll all be too old to fly.
They'll all be too old to fly.
You weren't forecasting.
No.
Our demise by 2029.
No. My point is, that's something that somebody should have been looking at, right?
Well, I mean, the problem with, I think businesses plan. I think our government only plans to the extent that our community values require that it plan. You know, our community values end up being our political values. Our government tends to reflect our political values. And we don't have this community interest that would cause us to look forward and think about what is the community going to be like. That's what plans are about. Plans are more about that than they are about individual. Individuals plan on their own if they can.
You know, Sandy, this issue, and it always makes me again think about, you know, places like China and other places, and I keep bringing up China simply because of the sheer numbers of people that they have, and then always going back to you and planning, and maybe that's the part of the business part of things that our government should be adopting, the planning part of it, the aspect of it. I don't know about the fact that businesses have all the answers to all the things, and that because somebody was in business, they're right for government. But I do think that it's short-sightedness if you don't look at what the businesses do and try to incorporate that in the way the government runs.
Well, I'm just suggesting that businesses, at least the ones that last, tend to look
right
forward in time and try and figure out how they're going to deal with the future as they foresee it. And our government just has a great deal of trouble doing that. And, you know, the notion that we would have a big tax reduction in the middle of a boom without looking forward in time to see what that would look like in a period of recession, I guess the theory was, well, if we have this big tax reduction, we'll never have another recession. That can't have been any sensible thinking. But, I mean, we continually, on both sides of the aisle, put our head in the sand and stop looking forward and worrying about what things will look like in the future. We do have people out there championing the future. I mean, the environmentalists worry about the environment in the future. And there are those who worry about how we will deal with Social Security, but there are some whose answer to that is, well, we'll just get rid of it. Well, that's not an answer, right? That's a non-answer, and that's a selfish answer. That's a non-community-based answer.
It's also a recipe for disaster.
Yes.
We're segueing into all of these different things that I had brought up. America needs a true wealth tax. Here's our plan to tax the rich. They really, really rich. You talked about the cuts. And at a time now where our proposed tax plan would reduce extreme wealth inequality, but would only target a very, very, very rich Americans. Maybe we don't know what a very, very, very rich American is, right? I mean,
There definitely are some, you know. I suppose I would qualify as something that's someone who's affluent, but there are people out there who are unbelievably affluent. But I think rather than talking about income equalization, which has a ring to it that, that is disturbing to some people. It's a little bit like the Marxian principle, you know, of equal, you know.
The redistribution of wealth is what
you're... redistribution of wealth. I think we should just talk about asking people to give back, to pay forward.
Do you think that works?
These people have prospered so much as the result of being lucky enough to have been born in America and lived in the American system that allows them to prosper so much on a lawful basis. There are people around the world who prosper greatly. There are the oligarchs in Russia. But they can't sleep at night soundly because probably they understand that they've done it with, many of them, through graft and corruption. People in America amass great amounts of wealth without any of that doubt and any of that conscience problem, because they're doing it all in an upright and legal fashion in a country that affords them that opportunity. But if that's the case, then they ought to feel generous about giving some small portion of it back to the community and reflecting their community interest, and not necessarily doing it through charity. Many of them can point at the Boys and Girls Club donation they made and whatever, but rather just giving back to the society what it is that society has afforded
them. But Sandy, I want to challenge the upright and legal fashion. Well, upright and legal doesn't always mean it's you know, because
I think most people in America who've gotten very wealthy have done it in an upright and legal and morally correct fashion.
So I guess I want to challenge the fact that when you see the amount of resources that they've been able to garner, at the same time the middle class has been in reverse. Yeah, it's legal. But it's been at the expense.
Well, it hasn't been at the expense of. It's been coincident with, okay?
Okay.
The idea that they're making their money at the expense of the middle class is not necessarily true. It might just be coincidental that the trends have worked that way. But I'm suggesting that on an individual basis, those people will perceive themselves as having carried out their lives in an entirely honest and moral fashion.
So, Sandy, let's go to a break. When we come back, we'll continue the conversation. Our phone lines are open at 844-967-2789. You can text us at the same number. We'll be right back. So I'm saying you got to go. Welcome back to the Earl Ingram Show. As always, you can join us at 844-967-2789. That's 844-967-2789. You can text us at that same number. If Sandy Williams is here, and I'm glad he's here. You know, we're talking about tax the rich. This is an article in today's Salon. It's America needs a true wealth tax. Here's our plan to tax the rich, the really, really rich. And let me read a quick paragraph. The danger that extreme wealth possesses to democracy is ever present, and the idea that it must be restrained is almost as old as democracy itself. In 1792, Thomas Paine wrote that the freedom of elections was violated by the overbearing influence of inherited wealth, and proposed an extremely aggressive wealth tax that would have put a hard ceiling on how much wealth a person could accumulate. Nearly a century ago, Supreme Court Justice Louis Brandeis famously observed, "We can have democracy in this country, or we can have great wealth concentrated in the hands of a few, but we can't have both." What is your thought on that, Sandy?
Well, it well might be true. Interestingly, Alexis de Tocqueville talked about that too, and how America was had an extreme anti-aristocratic trend in it that was all about inherited wealth and against inherited wealth. The notion being that wealth would churn And that it would migrate from the very wealthy back into the society at large, so that the very wealthy would not sustain their very wealthy status without contributing on a generational basis to the welfare of the community. And there is a lot of merit to the concept that wealth should not be something that is simply passed on, and that people should have something like the wealth that is generated by the value they create to society. But half of the motivation for chasing wealth does have to do with sharing it and having intergenerational wealth. So, it's a delicate balance. But what I was saying before the break, I think, holds, which is that this is, again, a question of community values. And what we need to imbue in society at large, but also in the wealthy in society, is the notion that our community provides a great deal of value to those of us who are succeeding, and that that value needs to imbue in each of us a community value to give back. And it's not trickle down like you were saying it during the break. It's not trickle down like Reagan talked about it. This is payback. This is the notion that society has been very, very good to us, to some of us, and that we ought to be very, very good to society in return. And how are we very good to society? We pay taxes. And those of us who accumulate a great deal of wealth and spend a great deal of energy trying to figure out the ways to avoid paying taxes are simply manifesting this anti-community, anti-social individualism that de Tocqueville noticed as being dangerous in 1830, and which is truly dangerous today, and which is what's causing our American society in many respects to be failing.
You know, Sandy, you, as opposed to just focusing on that group or that handful of people who have done those great things and are living their lives well. There's another part of all of this that impacts and affects people, and the fact that people who are struggling to make it in a society continue to struggle. And we talked about this last week, but I got to talk about it again. It's in today's Wall Street Journal. Congress rejects Biden's defense budget. So Joe Biden has offered a defense budget, reasonably, that cuts resources to the Pentagon, because he knows, and he's been a senator forever. He knows what's going on there, and he has proposed a reasonable budget.
Well, you say reasonable. He's proposed a budget that is smaller.
Right. then what?
One of the problems with the defense budget is that everyone's required to acknowledge that some huge budget is, in fact, reasonable without any kind of material. I mean, the fact is that I would guess, I don't know what number he's suggested, but it couldn't be, in under historical basis, more than a 5 or 8% reduction.
Which is outlandish when you hear other senators.
A 5 or 8% reduction would still leave it at well over $700 billion.
So here it is. The Senate Armed Services Committee recently passed a national defense authorization for the 2023 that would provide the Pentagon with $817 billion, mm-hmm, up from the roughly $773 billion the Biden administration requested, about a $45 billion
increase
difference.
Yeah.
The House Armed amended its initial draft in committee to about $37 billion.
That's $770 billion. That was an increase. Biden's proposed budget was an increase from the prior period. So this whole discussion we're having shows how sick we are with respect to our discussion of defense expenditures, because this is like an addiction to heroin, and we're talking about it like, well, yeah, it's a given. We're going to have to keep doing this, but the question is what dose level? And the fact is that this dose level is is so high that it's going to keep us from being able to do other things.
But it's the other things issue we're talking about. The baby boomers.
Because when we talk about the defense budget, we never talk about it like a household would have to talk about it. Like, if we spend the money here, then we can't spend it there. And in a household, you would talk about what we're spending it on here. We can't buy the Chris Craft boat that we're looking at because we need to have daycare for Johnny and Teddy, and we need to spend our money this way. And so you'd measure this against this. But when the defense budget comes up, we never have this against this. All we have is this.
Well, and that's because I think, Sandy, the American people, it's far too many of the American people don't know what $817 billion every year is.
Well,
right?
And we also don't know what danger we're actually spending that money to avoid. What is the public good that we're spending it to avoid? And, you know, is it solving the problems of Iraq? Is that why we're spending the money? Because when a problem comes up in Iraq, we're going to spend $500 billion there? Is that what we're planning for? Because the clear answer to that is no. The American public is not really willing to do that.
So I was reading something the other day. The amount of munitions that we've sent to Ukraine, the cost is somewhere around $7-8 billion of actually military weaponry that we've sent. We've sent 40-some-odd billion.
I think 53 billion is now what the numbers
are. Yeah, but that's not all in munitions.
But I don't think it's clear what it's all.
Okay. Yeah. So, but my point is, you think that's a lot, and it is, but when there's 817 additional billion, you kind of get the magnitude of what this really is, right?
But we should also figure out, what can $53 billion buy for Johnny?
Hey, got to go to a break. 844-967-2789. Tom, I see you. We'll come on the other side. You're tuning into the Earl Ingram Show. Sandy Williams, we'll be right back. You let me see one thing I wanted to see.
Well, actually, Tom, I didn't say that it was happening. I said that it should happen. I said that I thought that we had to develop a sense of community that we haven't developed, so that the people who've been so successful and have derived their success from this community would see the need to be community citizens and to give back and to pay back. And I think I suggested that Coke, at least, and lots of big businesses were playing the PR business, so they did understand the importance to the people of it, and that they weren't necessarily doing real things, but that maybe as people held their feet to the fire, the things they might do would become more real. So I just wanted to...
Isn't that being their feet being held to the fire? Isn't that government's job?
Absolutely. I didn't, we're not in disagreement. I just didn't want to get painted. I'm just trying to say.
No. I think we've lost ever since Reagan, and the whole idea of, survival of the fittest, or, the whole idea of trickle-down economics, that we've become very much a me individualism type of society. And I would like to know, what would be your solutions to getting us back to we are a community, and that you are gaining? Because I believe in the mom and pop businesses. I think one of the problems that we have in this country is that you have, small mom and pop businesses, and then you get some ridiculous rule at their store or whatever it is that's a regulation. And it plays right into the narrative on a larger level of business, of government not being in favor of business. But the truth is, Democrats have always been more, I would say, supportive of small and mom and pop businesses than the Republicans have been. But somehow they've gotten that moniker. And I would just like to know, how do we get back to the individual businesses realizing that we are a community? Because now you got people that are from other countries that are basically coming into the United States and buying it up left and right. And the property, I mean, here in California, there's so much property being bought off, by either the Saudis or whoever it might be. that are buying property right under our nose and owning the United States from the inside.
Well, you know, we had that issue with the Japanese 30 years ago. And look at what happened. That's no longer the case.
Well, people who buy property tend to sell it since they're buying it for a profit. But you're right. I think there is a problem with leadership. There's a problem culturally. And we've got to find a way to drive America in the direction of having changing its values. Because, you know, what we're describing here, and without being sort of trying to separate ourselves from this problem, I think that all of us are participating in a society that has lost its way and has lost its connection to community values, and it's reflected in so many ways by both our government's conduct, but also our individual conduct. The whole reaction to masking had a lot to do with messaging. People weren't, I think, told enough about how it was a community value. But on the other hand, I think that based on our reaction to a lot of other things, even given that messaging, a lot of people would have said, "Well, the hell with it. It doesn't matter to me."
Yeah,
I don't know how we get back to the idea of having a social democracy. I don't call it democratic socialism, but I call it social democracy, because messaging does matter. And, you know, the whole issue is money and politics. The whole issue is the Supreme Court's three court decisions, in Bilotti versus First National Bank and Citizens United and Buckley versus Vallejo. And those are the things that made corporations people. Those are the things that made it where the corporation can give unlimited funds to a campaign. If we got rid of that whole idea, if we got rid of the lobbyists out of Washington, which, good luck, but if we did, I'll tell you what, it would restore government back to we the people. And when we ask for Medicare for all, and we ask for things that actually help all of us, daycare, things like that, it would actually happen.
Well, you know, Tom, it can't be, from my perspective, it can't be that we keep seeing in this country more and more people who are not able to live the American dream, and what this nation was built on, and who basically live their lives as vagabonds in the wealthiest nation on earth. And
isn't that part of the problem, Earl, is that these people, since Reagan, think the American dream is being a millionaire or billionaire, rather than being, like FDR said, being able to take a vacation twice a year, being able to support your family, being able to buy a house. That was kind of the middle-class American dream back, you know, years ago. And it seems that we've lost that. We've lost that because of consumerism and because of the fact that, you know, we don't make things here, and we're much more service industry now
I do think you're onto something. I think just as being a person who coaches in sports, you have to find a couple of simple things that are doable that might change a whole variety of things if you really want to get things accomplished. You can't try and change everything. You have to change the things that might have a lot of leverage. And I agree with you that money in politics and the ability of politicians or the trend of politicians listening to no one but the moneyed interests has had a serious erosion, has an effect on what government does it, and it probably also affects the message that people are hearing and the society that they're experiencing, all of which has changed our values remarkably, I think, since 1960. I think our community values have dropped away. So I'm in agreement with you that getting money out of politics would be a very important step that might have an impact on a lot of other things.
But Sandy, the chances of that happening, slim and none, because we've already seen the impact of it. All of a sudden, somebody's going to all of a sudden get religion and say, oh yeah, by the way, this is...
Well, you know, interestingly, even CJ on the line about a month ago, agreed that money in politics was a problem.
I don't disagree.
I think that there might be a great deal more agreement about it. And the one,
but how thing, do you make it happen, though? Well, even though you can agree with,
I wasn't a fan of. I didn't think that Bernie had the energy left in him to be president. But now we've got Joe Biden, who has less. I do think that the progressive movement, in spite of my reluctance to embrace it, is the kind of thing that could wrap its arms around more thought and more thought processes in the country, particularly if the progressive movement centers itself on something as simple as getting money out of politics.
Well, I would think that would be the one area that we could all agree, and that's where I find agreement with my Republican comrades, so to speak, is that, we can all agree. That's why I asked CJ that a month ago about, can we agree on one thing, money and politics? And I think that's how it does start, is actually people being aware of the fact of what has happened in this country and how everything is owned by the billionaire class. And if we could just come together on that one simple thing and actually fight on that same issue all across the board. Wisconsin used to have some of the toughest campaign finance laws in the country. And now they have places where, Scott Walker could just basically change the whole landscape and the whole law and make things that were illegal legal. So I think it's going to take, just people being aware of the fact that money in politics is actually the cancer, and money in everything, honestly, money in media, money and all these different things. And Sandy, if you have a way of being able to change people's minds and make it where we are a society again, and we actually have to look out for each other, boy, am I open to that.
Hey, Tom,
boy,
thank you.
Happy about that.
Thank you very much for the call.
Thank you.
I guess, Sandy, it's almost like trying to get elected officials to do away with term.
Well, it could be we're on
to apply term limits to themselves. Who in Congress now is going to say, "Hey, yeah, that's a good idea. Let's the people who are there now, let's put term limits on ourselves." Not going to happen.
Maybe this conversation today is onto something. Maybe what we need to stop talking about is specifics in policy, and what we need to start talking about is generalities in morality and values, and talk about community values, and simply talk about that. And because I think there isn't anybody who wouldn't suggest that they believe in community values. Everyone thinks they do.
Right.
The question is, how do they manifest it and how do they act that out? And so maybe what we ought to do is just get back to a really basic principle of community values and then start applying it to various situations in politics. And one of the things that's keeping us from having community values reflected undoubtedly is money in politics.
Yeah. Got to go to a break. 844-967-2789. Phone lines are open. In the studio, Sandy Williams. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Earl Ingram Show. As always, you can join us at 844-967-2789. That's 844-967-2789. You can text us at that same number. It's Monday. That means Mondays with Sandy Williams. And Sandy, we cannot not come and have conversations without talking about Ukraine and where Ukraine is, because we talk about Ukraine from a lot of different perspectives, but we haven't talked about it much from this perspective. And where is it at? It's going to appear in a minute. You know, there's now, Sandy, a impact that we talked about and you've been talking about for a long time about what was going to happen to many other nations as they suffer the lack of food. It's starting to manifest itself in hunger, in nations, starting to build up in the poorest people. Ukraine war, again, the Wall Street Journal today, pushes millions of the world's poorest towards starvation. We're not hearing much about that. It's starting to happen. Once it starts moving, it's going to be difficult to turn it around as long as the war is still in existence. If we talk more about that, do you think it'll have any impact at all?
Well, it could. You know, the supply chain of food is one of the most cumbersome. You know, it's not easy to change that. It's something that's it's a constant marketplace. And, you know, there's so much food being manufactured or essentially grown and harvested. And that amount grown and harvested isn't much different than the amount that's consumed, right? Because there's,
right.
Because farms basically adjust their output to avoid waste. So when you reduce the amount of food that's being harvested, or at least the amount of food that's available to the rest of the world out of harvest, it's hard to replace that. So yeah, it's going to be hard to impact that if you just look at it from a strict marketing market standpoint,
supply and demand. You know, Sandy, when we go back to 30 years ago, Mogadishu in Somalia, they would show these children with the big bellies and all of those things, and it really tugged on the heartstrings of people in this country who would see that.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's starting to manifest itself again. There was a time not long ago before this war that we started seeing some of those things even out in those nations, starting to overcome that. But they've only been, you know, one skirmish away from that happening again. And so we are headed towards the throes of that again. And I don't, I guess for the life of me, globally, there was an imperative that addressed those issues. Is that still there?
Well, those issues were much more localized in terms of the impact. Now we've got a huge supply-side problem that's being generated based on the percentage of the world food that was being supplied by the combination of Russia and Ukraine, and the extent to which that supply is now being diminished as a result of the war, and then the further issue of how do you replace that supply in a short period of time. Out of a world supply of food that is more or less balanced between supply and demand, because you know we aren't storing up food across the world at any rate each year, because the supply basically is generated in a manner that reflects the demand. So it's going to be a difficult problem to solve, and it's not necessarily one that can be solved easily out of a surplus of food that's being created someplace like in the United States.
You know, I remember the first time I heard you talk about supply chain, and most American people don't think about supply chain unless you guys have gone through, people have gone through training and understand the inner workings of all of that. The average American knows nothing about that.
Mm-hmm.
All we know is that we go to a store, something's there, we buy it, and we never think about a global supply chain. We think we're America and nothing's going to interfere in our entire lives unless something like this happens with that, so we don't focus on any of those things, but other nations have been focusing on supply and the way things move around the world for a long, long time.
Well, and for instance, when Trump started having his tariff war, there developed a serious problem with respect to food that was in international trade, because that's a complicated aspect of the supply chain. There were a large number of food, for instance, I think livestock, that was grown in the United States that was being sent to China that was put in jeopardy as the result of the counter tariffs that were being exercised by China in the trade war.
So I guess my thing is, hasn't been negotiations, or there can't be negotiations between Russia and the rest of the world to make it possible to allow the free movement of food to other nations?
Well, I think there is pressure being put on Russia with respect to that issue. There is also the problem that during a period of war, when a huge number of part of the manpower of Ukraine is now dedicated to war rather than farming, I'm sure there's a great deal of potential wastage of the Ukrainian wheat crop, for
right.
instance, as a result of war, that can't be solved by Russia. I mean, they
right.
could be solved, I suppose, but the war is making it impossible for that wheat to be generated by Ukraine. And so there are two problems. Some of it is that the wheat being produced by Ukraine is being short-stopped and it's been made more difficult to export it from Ukraine to the rest of the world.
Well, isn't it backed up because of what that was already there that they couldn't get out and they're harvesting
yeah.
now?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, there's the food chain within Ukraine is clearly severely impacted by the war, and the capacity, first of all, that food is almost all shipped by ship,
right?
And so the ability to move ships out of Ukrainian ports is an issue that is being talked about in the world, and there are negotiations with Russia trying to make sure that they can move them out. Russia's pointing out that a number of the ports through which they would move have been mined and have been mined by Ukrainian military in order to avoid the entry into those ports of Russian ships. It's complicated. Warfare makes commerce very much more difficult.
You know, Sandy, it is the early stages of this hunger that they're talking about that people are going to be faced with if they mine the sea, going to take a long time to even make it possible for those ships to get through, even afterwards, right? I mean, when they mine, it's not a simple process to then turn around and go and reclaim the mines.
Right. I mean, clearing mines is a process, and during a war, it's hard for Ukraine to divert its resources from defending itself and fighting the war to clearing mines. Right. So, you know, in a period of war, a country would look at its triage, its priorities. What are the most important priorities? And unfortunately, the exporting of food product might drop down on its priorities, well down the list from self-defense, from the rest of the priorities that are involved with the execution of the war.
So I guess, Sandy, I'm not looking at and expecting Ukraine to be focused and concerned about the fact that other nations are going to be suffering from, they got their hands full worrying about survival.
Right.
But I would have thought that the United Nations and other organized nations would.
Well, they have been worried about it. I mean, half the reason we have this news is the United Nations has been telling us about it and forecasting it. The United Nations has a limited capacity to affect.
Do anything about it
for the reason I described. There's so much food produced, so much food is consumed, and it's to some extent a pie that needs to get divided up amongst the people of the world.
All right, got to go to a break. 844-967-2789 is Monday. That means Mondays with Sandy Williams. We'll be right back.
So, Sandy, it's also to my brother. And I say, brother, help me, please. But he winds up knocking me back down on my knees. know.